I'm really excited because it's the beginning of a new series. Kind of this term, we're going to be spending it in John's Gospel, and we're going to be spending it with Jesus. I just love spending time with Jesus, so that for me seems to be a great thing to be doing. What we're going to be doing is looking at some of the different encounters that Jesus has with different individuals throughout John's Gospel. And kind of through it, I hope we're going to get to look at some of the big questions about life, about meaning, about purpose, about God, and kind of how we can explore those questions kind of in a healthy way. In a sense, today's kind of number two in the series, because we kind of did a mini one last week, kind of for family service. But this is kind of this is in a way kind of part introduction to the whole series. And as well as what we're doing here on Sunday mornings, house groups are going to be looking at the same passages. Don't worry if you kind of miss a talk, what happens in the house group notes kind of will work kind of completely independently of what's being said, but hopefully they're kind of cross-reference a bit too. So kind of really, really excited about that. So today we begin with Nathanael, and I think we're really looking about what it means to be healthily skeptical, to kind of have questions in a way that's helpful and good for us. And I really like to begin with the setting. And it kind of begins before Jesus meets Nathanael. It's when Nathanael's sitting under that fig tree. Could I have the next slide? Thanks. Because even before Jesus meets Nathanael, kind of he sees him. And so when he does meet him and he does have this conversation with him and kind of, and Nathanael's got these questions, kind of Jesus said, I saw you sitting under that fig tree. And kind of that seems to be the key to the whole thing that opens everything up when Nathanael goes, flip, what's going on here? So what on earth does it mean to be sitting under, the fig tree? People seem to think it's like a cultural phrase. You know, like there's some phrases that kind of mean something in our society that we get and mean something to us. But if you use them in another time, in another place, they would make no sense to anyone. So if I said to you, I'm going off down the Cross Keys, you would know exactly what I meant, wouldn't you? Kind of, you would know that I'm going there to have a very deep and meaningful conversation with a parishioner and care for them at a very deep pastoral level. Actually, that probably wouldn't be what that phrase would actually mean, would it? But for me, that conversation would probably more likely happen in Costa than in the Cross Keys. But you kind of get what I mean. You know what I mean when I use that phrase. And it would seem that actually when people talked about sitting under the fig tree, it might kind of seem like gobbledygook to us. Actually, probably it had meaning to people in Jesus' day. And the best sense that people have of it is that sitting under the fig tree was the place in a hot climate where people went to pray and to contemplate and reflect on the deep questions of life, trying to make sense of life. So actually there's a sense that we all sit under the fig tree, isn't there? We all have questions of life. We hopefully try and find time to think through kind of those questions and find answers to them. So kind of that's the starting point for this series in a way, that we're all sitting under the fig tree. We're all trying to make sense of life. We've all got questions about life. A psychologist called Dan Gilbert said, apparently he's a happiness expert. Looking around, Linda, you're a counsellor. You're a happiness. I don't know. That's a kind of a strange kind of phrase, isn't it? A happiness expert. He said that human beings are the only living creatures that think about their future. Interesting thought, isn't it? You know, it's one of the things that makes us distinctively different from any other kind of living creature. Kind of we are preoccupied, not just with now and whether I'm hungry or where I might sleep or what I might wear, but actually we are people that are preoccupied about the future. Apparently, and I don't know whether, you know, we are average people here or not, apparently the average human being spends 12% of every day thinking about something that's future related. That's quite incredible, isn't it? I mean, I don't know whether that would be true for you or not. I mean, I don't know whether, I don't even know whether I do really. I don't know whether I have time to kind of work that one out even either. Kind of, it's part of that never-ending search for meaning. We look forward and we wonder what the future's going to look like, but we also find ourselves looking back. Did I take the right job? Am I living in the right place? Did I marry the right person? Kind of, we can often be filled with uncertainty about the decisions we have made and also the decisions that we are going to have to make. It's that sense of looking for answers. And actually, the big question is whether we're looking for answers in the right place. And ultimately, why we're doing this series is it comes out of the belief that actually the answers aren't found in a place, but they're found in a person. And that person is Jesus. And that can kind of sound a bit glib. Let me just kind of share you just something of kind of what I mean. And this is just some out of something that happened to me this week, something I had to do this week. This week, kind of was a bit mad. I had three funerals that I was involved in. My ex-boss from when I was a curate in London, an older member of our congregation. But in the middle of the week, by far the most difficult, and probably one of the most difficult things I've ever had to do, Callum Rowe's funeral, which will be, you know, Callum will be familiar to many of you. Some of us knew him kind of since he was this high. And he was only 27 years old. Tragically, Callum had lost kind of, just somehow lost his way. He was caught up in depression and he'd taken his own life. And I find it hard to get my head around. I'd known Callum, probably known Callum for 17, 18 years. Kind of, I'd lost track of him in recent years until literally a month ago I saw him twice in the Cross Keys, funnily enough. And kind of, I would never have dreamt he was in that place of desperation. It's one of those things where you don't want to be involved, but you know that you also want to be involved because you want to somehow support the family in the best possible way you can. And the family were trying to make sense of it. And I know both mum and dad and, I have a relationship with them that goes back years ago, although they now live in Scotland. And we kind of tried to make this service kind of something that really reflected Callum's life. And I found myself having to juggle all sorts of things that they really wanted included in this service. There was a quote they wanted, which was all about Callum's choice to do what he wanted, and that was pretty brutal. But the thing that I found hardest was Dad was going to say something, and he wanted a song played after what he had said and before what I was going to say. And he kind of felt that this song would kind of join together what the two of us were going to say. So I knew I had to take the song seriously. And it was a Linkin Park song, What I've Done. And it was just incredibly emotive. It's emotive in the first instance that it's written by and sung by someone that chose to take their own life. That kind of makes it all the more loaded. But the phraseology of the song, and it talks about wanting to erase oneself, which is effectively what Callum had done. Incredibly painful. And I think, how am I going to speak out of this without making the wounds deeper? And yet in the middle of it, there was a refrain that was repeated again and again that just kind of seemed to speak truth into the situation. Just the lines, let mercy come and wash away what I've done. Just incredibly, just depth in those words. Let mercy come and wash away what I've done. And, the more I thought about it, the more I thought, mercy has come. Mercy has come. And mercy is a person. And the name of that person is Jesus. The answers that we seek and we strive for, they're found in a person. Mercy is found in a person, and those answers are found in a person. And so kind of it can seem trivial at first. It's a bit like the classic joke that kind of, people tell from Sunday school, isn't it? Which has been told I don't know how many times. What's fluffy and got long ears and a kind of a round tail? And kind of the kids look at each other and say, Well, it sounds like a bunny, but it's Sunday school, so it must be Jesus. You know, because that's the, you know, we can kind of trivialize that whole thing about it. But actually, in all seriousness, when life is at its most painful and broken, actually, that's the place where answers are found. So what can we learn from this encounter between Jesus and Nathanael? It seems to me that Nathanael gets one thing right and two things wrong. And actually, it's really helpful if we learn not just from kind of what people get right, but also from their mistakes, because it can help us making the same mistakes, can't stop us from making the same mistakes. So let's do the good thing first. What's the good thing that Nathanael gets right that we can learn from? And Nathanael is described, come to the next slide, as a true Israelite in whom there is nothing false. And what he gets right is what Jesus commends him for. He's a true Israelite, or as an older translation puts it, an Israelite in whom there is no guile. There's nothing false about him. It's actually a remarkable compliment. And it's also a play on words, actually. I don't know whether you kind of spotted that. Kind of the nation of Israel's kind of roots and their name as a nation come from the patriarchs, right from the beginning of the Jewish nation, when God speaks to Abraham and kind of God works in his life and then in Isaac's life and then in Jacob's life. And kind of all these promises about them and being a nation, it all kind of begins there. And Jacob, the grandson of Abraham, Isaac's son, his name means deceiver or grabber. But he has an encounter with God, and we're talking about encounters with God this time, and that encounter with God is kind of life-changing. And he's given a new name, and his new name is Israel. And that means wrestling with God. It kind of comes out of that very encounter he has with God. And it's from him, you know, we know the Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat story. He has these sons, and those sons become the heads of the tribes of Israel. And it's from him the whole of Israel kind of grows. And so kind of Jesus is almost saying here, behold an Israelite, or behold an Israel in whom there's no Jacob. This is an Israel that doesn't deceive. You know, Jacob was a deceiver, someone that kind of manipulated, and he gets a new name, he becomes Israel. And he says, here's an Israelite who doesn't deceive, who doesn't cheat. There's kind of this play on words in that. And that's Nathanael. When you look at Nathanael, what you see is what you get. Jesus commends him for his openness, and his honesty. Now, please don't go away wounded. The problem is, actually, that's not an easy way to live, is it? I don't know about you. I don't always find it easy to, you know, I'm not suggesting that any of us are dishonest, kind of in kind of a legal way or something like that. But actually, it can be quite hard to live in a place of openness. It's incredibly tempting to kind of erect a facade that we present for others, a mask that we put on, and live behind that. And we do it for a variety of reasons. Sometimes actually it removes the pain, you know, because if we were to really show people what we're really like, we would find ourselves having to deal with things that would be difficult. Sometimes it's because actually we don't really like ourselves, and if we don't like ourselves, we find it hard to imagine that others will like us. Someone has said that the greatest moment of dishonesty in every church takes place the moment that the service ends. That sounds a bit uncomfortable, doesn't it? But actually what they're referring to is that kind of question that gets asked as we share coffee and as we kind of reconnect. How are you? And what is the response that kind of flows onto most of our lips? And I know that I do this. Oh, I'm fine. you know? And sometimes it's because sometimes some of the stuff we're dealing with, actually, there's a question of appropriateness, where you share one thing. Sometimes it's not always right to share it. But sometimes actually it's just safer to say we're fine and not really kind of let people know how we're really feeling inside. And actually what Nathaniel is commended for is being real and honest, and at times actually quite brutal. It's actually quite rude about Jesus, as we'll see in a moment. That's how straightforward he is, not hiding things. But the reality is, if we want to change, if we want to see our lives transformed, actually, that begins with openness. It begins with being real about who we are and where we are and the struggles that we deal with. Because actually all the time we are in denial about those things, all the time we are pushing them down or hiding them away, actually we're being robbed of the power to deal with them. Yeah, and so the first challenge in this passage is the challenge to be open and to be real and to live our lives without masks. And actually, that's not an easy challenge, is it? So that's what he gets right. But as I said, we can learn also from people's mistakes. So kind of what next? Can I have the next slide? Well, actually, he dismisses Jesus too quickly. He kind of writes Jesus off. You might have already been doing that this morning when I kind of stood up here and said, life has many questions. And actually, the answer's found in Jesus. When I said, no, mercy is found in Jesus, you might have said, oh, please, he's not going to say that again. It's too simple, you know, it's too simple. It doesn't kind of meet the complexity of my life and the stuff that's going on in my life. It can be so easy to kind of dismiss Jesus, and he does. Philip goes up to him and says, we found the one Moses spoke about and about whom the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, Joseph's son. He's saying, we found the Messiah. And Philip is so excited because he's already had this encounter with Jesus and decided that he wants to follow Jesus. Aren't people like that quite annoying at times? You know, when they got it all sewn up and you haven't got it sewn up? Philip's like that. And Nathaniel's response is quite a human one. You must be joking. Kind of Nazareth? You know, can anything good come out of Nazareth? I've been to Nazareth. It's an interesting town now because of where it is now, kind of it's kind of built up and it's developed. But at the time of Jesus, probably no more than 30 people lived there. And actually, it was at the time of Jesus a very primitive place to live. It was literally holes in the rock that people lived in. They didn't even live in proper houses. I'm trying to think about what city I might slander in this country, but I won't because someone will come from there and they're going to take me out and sort me out later. It's just one of those places that has a reputation for kind of nothing good coming out of it. That's why Nathaniel replies in the way he does. And because of that, he kind of writes off Jesus. Jesus couldn't be the Messiah because that's not the sort of Messiah. You know, a Messiah wouldn't come from Nazareth. He's looking for someone that's going to be powerful and influential that's going to be a Messiah. No one influential can come out of Nazareth because they are poor people and they have no influence. Nathaniel's judging by the world's standards and not by God's standards. A Christian sociologist called James Davidson Hunter kind of argues that when societies crumble, and dare I say it, there may be a sense that that happens at the moment, that power gets concentrated in political force. It moves from kind of the broader cultural aspects of society, kind of education, media, arts, kind of the inbuilt values that are in society, and it kind of gets concentrated in a political force that can make things happen. And sometimes that can be oppressive, and sometimes people are looking for an alternative force that will counter that, that will bring about the change they hope. But what happens is when society breaks down, kind of things, rather than the broader base of values that shape our society, it all gets put into political force and political control and political argument. It becomes about cohesive power, power to get something done, power to force something through. And I'm going to be very rude here. Well, not rude. I think there's a danger of this happening in our nation at the moment. The rise of nationalism, the sense of welcome that used to be in this country towards people from other backgrounds and nationalities, people that were struggling. You know, suddenly it becomes about self-interest and protectionism, and looking after ourselves. When we see politics going on, there are far too many accusations of bullying. If someone holds a different opinion, even within a political party, rather than being heard, they're shouted down. It becomes about force, and it becomes about... it becomes about control and about power. And just in case that you're thinking I'm talking about just what happens on the news, we all do it to some degree. Anyone here not said to their child when they ask them to do it and they won't do it and they say, why should I do it? Because I said so. That's all about, you know, force and power. And of course, none of us would do that. I never did that. Isn't it good that my kids are here today to contradict me? Israel is under Roman rule. It's under kind of a political force that's controlling them. And they can't shake free from it. When they look for a Messiah, they are really looking for someone that will raise a bigger political force and will change it the other way. And that's what Nathaniel's looking for. And that's why he can't believe that they could possibly come out of Nazareth. Because that sort of power wouldn't come from there. And that's the world's way of thinking. It's about, you know, changing things is about more influence or more power or more money, more control. And that's not the kingdom of God. It's like the opposite to the kingdom of God. There's a book. Anyone read or seen the film Touching the Void? Anyone know that? A couple of people. I mean, I've only read a little bit about it. I've not actually read the book, but it's about a guy called Joe Simpson and his climbing partner who make a successful climb of a peak in the Andes. But on the way down, something goes wrong. What goes wrong is that Simpson breaks his leg and is nearly immobilized. And it gets worse because they start running out of food and water and they get separated. And he finds himself in a crevasse, trying again to climb up and out of that crevasse. And after repeated attempts, he knows he's only getting weaker and he hasn't got the strength to climb anymore. So he makes the decision to do what is totally illogical, and that's to climb back down in the crevasse. Not knowing whether there's a way out, but that's the only hope he has, is to go down and to go lower. And actually, sorry, bit of a spoiler, he finds his way out. I've now spoiled it for you if you actually go and read it, haven't I really? But sorry, forgive the vicar and his illustration. But I think that's the picture of the kingdom. The world says to make something better, we have to be stronger and more powerful. But actually, the kingdom is actually about being willing to go lower and about being willing to enter in. That's what Jesus did, isn't it? You know, rather than come into this world and shake it up, he comes into this world and enters into our humanity and into our brokenness and lives amongst us. He chooses to go lower. He takes our flesh. He accepts our brokenness. The way to success in our lives isn't about a better job or more money. It's actually the opposite. It's about willing to give up our lives so we might gain our lives. And I think people's attitudes to Jesus are still very similar. People are tempted to dismiss him. He lived 2,000 years ago. He died, but people claim he raised him dead. How can that be true? No wonder people are skeptical. Next week, Graham is going to be talking about his journey kind of from skepticism to faith when we look at Nicodemus. People still want to find it very tempting and want to reject and dismiss Jesus just as Nathaniel did. I just really want to challenge you to take a proper look at Jesus. And probably the starting point for that actually is the resurrection. If you want to know more about it, we'll be running a course later this autumn called 7 Signs that looks at Jesus. Come along and join with us on that if you want to if you don't want to dismiss Jesus, if you want to take him seriously. And it's not just about believing in Jesus and taking him seriously. It's about taking seriously how he lives. You know, it's about being willing to go with him into the crevasse. That impacts our lives in every way. It impacts the choices we make about our money, whether we choose to keep our money or give it away. That actually also has national implications. I am disgusted, is the only word for it. Disgusted at Tunbridge Wells. Isn't that great? I live here and I'm disgusted at Tunbridge Wells. I am utterly disgusted that in a nation that has so much, we could be contemplating reducing the pitiful amount of money that we give to the poorest nations in the world. We give 0.7% of our national GDP in foreign aid to the poorest of the people in this world, to the people that are facing the most difficult. And we are being told we can't afford to give less than 1% away because we need to put that money into our health service. Family's like, we just need to pay more tax. Sorry. That will sort out our health service. The idea of taking money from the poorest, that's the world's way. The kingdom way is to give away what we have, not to hang on to it. And you can see that's part of this culture that we live in now that moves from kind of the values that are right, which are about generosity, to ones that are narrow, that are about self-preservation and protectionism and are about force. We need to choose to go lower into the crevasse. Finally, the second mistake that Mr. Annual makes, and you would kind of think this is a great one, why would this ever be a mistake, you know, is the danger of embracing Jesus too quickly. Nathaniel jumps from one extreme to the other. One minute he's skeptical. How can anything good come out of Nazareth? And when Jesus says, well, I saw you under the fig tree, suddenly he goes, wow, you're the Messiah. Wow, Rabbi, you really are the Son of God. You can't make a bigger jump, can you? It's huge, isn't it? He jumps from one extreme to the other. And the danger of a series like this, when you give it the title, Encounters with Jesus, is it can imply that it is just simple like that, a quick fix. You have an encounter with Jesus, everything changes in your life, and everything becomes easier from henceforth. And actually, sometimes, when we choose to follow Jesus, things don't get easier, they get harder. He went into the crevasse, and that's where he calls us to go lower, and to be prepared to die to self, that we might live for him. It's harder following him, and actually, it's not necessarily about a quick fix. Sometimes it's about a life that's transformed a step at a time. And we live in a world that is all about the instantaneous. I was earwigging a conversation that Matt was having about how great his son is at golf now. How great Dan is at golf last night. Do you remember that conversation? The trouble is it's the golf on the PlayStation that he's got really good at. What's his handicap on PlayStation golf? But I mean, he's been playing it half an hour. And he's got the most amazing handicap. That, I mean, could I do that with my golf play? But in real life? But the problem is we live in a world where computer games and social media and kind of just the stuff we watch on TV, it kind of implies that kind of we can have everything and we can have it now. And actually, that sets everyone up for disappointment. You know, the rise in mental health issues, particularly amongst young people, a lot of it comes from people being sold a lie that you can have all your dreams come true and you can have them all tomorrow. And if, to be honest, if winning the national lottery would solve your problems, then probably your dreams are not big enough. That's not going to really solve anyone's problem. In most cases, transformation comes a step at a time. And Jesus is almost saying to Nathaniel, whoa, step back a bit. You know, great, you can see that now, but you're going to see more. You've got to come on this journey with me, and then you'll see more. We get changed a step at a time. And I'll bring a story because I find this absolutely mind-boggling, and I'll use this story just to come to a close. It's about a guy called Cliff Young. Anyone heard of Cliff Young? Crumbs, this is good. I've got original things that you've never heard of before. How exciting is that? At 61 years of age, Cliff Young, who was a potato farmer, decided to take part in the inaugural Westfield Sydney to Melbourne ultra marathon. You wonder how long an ultra marathon is? Any runners out there? An ultra marathon is 21 marathons, 544 miles. And he signed up for it. And I would have thought in this day and age they would do checks and they wouldn't let you sign up for it at 61. Particularly when he was asked, have you trained for it? And he said, no, I've never run a marathon in my life. And he turned up for it in waterproofs when all the other guys were wearing running things and in kind of boots rather than running shoes. And he joined in and they let him run this marathon. At the end of the first day, it was kind of tortoise and hare stuff. He was at the back and everyone had just left him completely for dust. But he hadn't run any marathons. He'd just run around his farm all of his life, basically chasing sheep. And apparently the way you do these sorts of things, because it's continuous, is you run for 18 hours, you rest for 6 hours, and then you run for 18 hours, and you rest for 6 hours, and that's how you maintain your strength. This is a coaching session that is free on top of the sermon for anyone that wants to do an ultra marathon. You know, come along, I'll be your trainer, just don't ask me to run it. No one had told Cliff Young that's what you're meant to do. So when everyone else stopped and rested, he just kept on running. And he just kept on running. And he just kept on running. And I guess if you think about it, shepherds are used to working through day and night when they're lambing and stuff like that. He just kept on running. And he ran it in 5.5 days. He ran it 10 hours faster than the person that came in behind him second, with all of the training and all of the practice and all of the right gear. And he won it because he just kept running. He didn't stop. And that's what the Christian life is like. You know, we feel like giving up. We want to have a stop. No, we just keep on going. We keep on going down into the crevasse. We keep on making choices that I will worship even though I don't feel like worshipping. That I will give even though I don't know where the money's going to come on from. That I will serve even though I don't know where the time is going to come from to fit these things in. That I will live in a way that is radically different to the world around us. And that's the pattern that Christian life is about. Not about a quick fix, but about a keeping on going. Let's stand. We're going to pray together.